This present podcast in our series may be of special interest to conservative pessimists and depressives, and it occurs to me that most of my conservative friends are on the pessimistic or depressive side when it comes to their sense of the future and what it holds. Many of them fear that it holds more of what we've been suffering through in recent years, not merely in the current political administration, but rather in the general decline, disorder, and even decay visible in the main sectors of Western civilization. Comes to our rescue a very interesting new book titled America 3.0. Its authors are James Bennett and Michael Lotus. And Michael Lotus is with us today. Michael, let's prove that you're here. Say hello.
Hello.
And now let me just quickly set the stage this way. The thesis of your book, as I've been reading it, and I've been reading it with great interest, seems to be that America has exhausted its economy, its bureaucratic and educational and social institutions, that its big government as dependable parent system of reassurance is actually near collapse, and that all of this is happening even as the current empowered cabal strives to redistribute wealth, to redefine and reduce the autonomy of individuals, and to build themselves a sort of permanent and truly passive supporting majority. As you think about all of that and read this very interesting book of yours, one half believes, the one being me, that it was all foreseen by Yeats in his great poem when he says, "The worst are full of passionate intensity, the best lack all conviction, the center will not hold." But, I say to our listeners, despair not. Out of the ruins, out of the ashes, there will rise Phoenix-like, a new America. And we will call it, or at least our guest, Michael Lotus, and his co-writer, James Bennett, call it America 0.30. So cast your eye forward to, say, the year 2040, which they do. And I will ask directly, what will 2040 look like, Michael Lotus?
Well, 2040 is a sort of arbitrary date we've picked, at which point we hope, and we think we're conservative, actually, the very painful transition we're going through now will have been pretty much completed, and some of the technological changes we hope will occur will have matured.
When you say transition, you mean from a prior stage in our national, cultural, and economic life, which you call America 2.0. That was preceded by the American culture and economy of the era or the period of 1.0, which runs from, say, the Revolution or pre-Revolution up to the end of the Civil War. Perhaps we need to first establish that view across time that you and your co-author develop here.
Happy to do it. And I think it's pretty clear, obviously, that the United States of America and its hundreds of millions of people over multiple centuries is not, you know, a software project with multiple iterations. It's a metaphor. But we think that the firmware, the underlying culture, has been continuous, though changing over many centuries. And the era of the founding and before was a period of muscle power and animal power, not machine power. It was a period of small farms, small businesses, very few large enterprises. Cities were small, towns were small. Government was face-to-face. Law enforcement was localized and face-to-face. And the federal government at the time of our founding was a very small presence in the lives of most people.
And as Jefferson told us, the basic unit of this government, or rather of this culture, is the family on its farm.
Correct. And Jefferson was harking back to many, many centuries of the English-speaking world and the sort of ideal life that the families and people of the English-speaking world would like to have. Anyone who could afford to do it wanted to own their own home and own their own means of personal well-being, whether it was a business, but usually a farm, and extracting their living from the earth in that fashion. The America 2.0 is the era of industrial America. And while we pick a sort of arbitrary start date around the time of the end of the Civil War, obviously for many, many years before that, we're starting to see the early signs of this. We had water-powered mills in New England two generations before that. But as this new technology came in, new fundamental new technology of power machinery, we had railroads, we had factories, then we had automobiles, we had the diesel-powered trains, we had streetcars, we had automobiles, we have electric power and electric power transmission. This transformed everything.
So you are of the historical school, which assumes, as a basic proposition, that technology leads, that technology is the key to significant social change, whether evolutionary or devolutionary. But what actually activates technology? Did we have similar technological progress elsewhere in the world? Was it matched in Europe? Was it matched in the UK and in Western Europe during the same time that it was transforming America?
Okay, well, we believe that technology is one of many major drivers. We are shy from monocausality. Lots of things are going on, but very significant things happen when there's a major change in technology. Now, it's the case that the modern world and the modern world of the Industrial Revolution and the fundamental technological change did not just occur by happenstance in any old place. It started in England, in lowland Scotland, but basically the same place. And it happened because a lot of very important factors came together there at the same time.
And it's what we commonly label the Industrial Revolution, isn't it?
Precisely. Yeah. The Industrial Revolution was the hinge moment in history that you saw a takeoff in material well-being, life expectancy, all kinds of other things that are mostly very, very positive. And those occurred in England because there was an institutional and legal and cultural foundation that made the scientific and technical changes not only possible, but that allowed them to then disseminate out into the economy and start to work their magic of transforming the lives of the masses of ordinary people. And
why has that not continued well apace? Why do we not still essentially enjoy, with optimistic anticipation of the future, enjoy the America 2.0 way of life and way of culture, rather than increasing dissatisfaction, increasing pessimism, increasing depression over the prospect before us?
Okay, well, I think we're fortunate. You know, in China, they've had multiple dynasties. So they have the ebb and flow of all the things that have happened in the past to learn from. In our case, we have the good fortune that our society has made a very basic economic and political change once in our history, from the agricultural world to the world of industrial America. And we say that the technology coming is on that scale. So what did we see in the late 19th century? We saw very much the kind of despair that many people feel now. We saw that whole ways of life that people had come to believe were normal and expected and what the world was ordinarily meant to be like fading away. You saw millions upon millions of people leaving the farms, millions of people coming here from abroad, and lots of people saying the America we knew and loved is going away. It's all over. We're going to lose our constitution. We're going to lose our freedom. There was an element of racism, as 19th century people had, in a way that we no longer tolerate, but that was there as well. And they couldn't foresee that this change was ultimately going to play out, that the pain of the transition was going to lead to something that was better, a happier, safer, healthier, longer-lived population doing less dirty, less dangerous jobs for a better material state of being. That's what we ended up with.
Your book is about America. The title, as I've said, is America 3.0. But was essentially the same pattern visible in the 19th century history and on into the middle of the 20th century among at least our cousin countries? That is to say, Western Europe, Canada, Australia. And where else was that visible?
Well, we make a pretty important distinction between the English-speaking world and everybody else. And we base that on the family structure that underlies the English-speaking peoples and all the communities that they've created around the world. Now, the people, other countries in Europe are more similar to us, say, than in China or the Arab and Persian Middle East and other such places. But really, the English-speaking world has what is called the absolute nuclear family, as the social scientists call it. And that particular type of family has distinct characteristics that we share with our English-speaking cousins and very few other people. And we say that that culture gave rise to the political and legal institutions that grew up on it.
Now here you've got a very strong, or at least a very interesting, socio-psychological premise or socio-psychological hypothesis, and that is that a certain kind of family tends to foster a pattern of economic and general transformative development that you talk about when we go from the 1.0 to the 2.0 part of our history, and which similarly undergirds our movement now towards the 3.0 transformation of our history. The hypothesis then simply is certain kinds of family produce the kinds of people who can mount such patterns of social change successfully and are motivated to do so. Now, the nuclear family means the family that takes good care of the kids. Women have more freedom than they have in other kinds of social systems, other kinds of families. But most important, there are no guarantees to the parents that the kids will maintain them throughout their longer, older lives. And the kids go off, in the usual pattern, to found their own families, usually not living together with the parents, as might be the case even in urban India to some degree these days, but rather the nuclear family keeps generating other nuclear families. There are ties maintained, but they may wither away rather quickly also. Most Americans don't know much about their great-grandparents, though for fun they now turn to services for which they pay a small fee to look into their genealogy. But we are essentially a people of the present, it seems to me.
That's all correct. And this is quite different from many other societies. The extended families in other parts of the world, either you get a kind of a cost and a benefit from those. The cost is it's tough to advance beyond them. If you start to have some success, you have to share it. You can't accumulate capital. On the other hand, there's a safety net there. You're not going to be allowed to fail too completely if your extended family feels a lot of personal obligation to take care of you. The English-speaking world has been a high-risk, high-return type of community because of the type of family life it has, and where you have to pick your own spouse. They're not picked for you. You're on your own there. And if you get it wrong, repent at leisure. But if you do well and you select a career that's going to be good for you and you're going to take advantage of some opportunities and you succeed in life, much of what you get, you're allowed to keep, and that's considered to be fair play.
Now, your Anglo-Saxon culture and tradition and the kinds of families it generates and sustains, that isn't restricted to people of German, English, or for that matter, earlier Danish and Jute inheritance. You can be black, you can be Hispanic, and also Anglo-Saxon, so to speak.
Right. That's right. The Anglo-Saxonism, if you will, of the 19th century writers was ethnic in their thinking, but it's quite clear after 150 years of further history that that's not correct at all. People from every conceivable ethnic group can come to the English-speaking world, particularly the United States, which has a positive genius for assimilating people. And over a couple of generations, you simply cannot live the way you did in the old country. You can't pick your children and grandchildren's spouses for them. You can't mandate that they're going to care for you when you're old, and they can't compel you to give them anything of what you have.
If that is true, though, if that's true, and the Anglo-Saxonization of family life on the part of those who are not Anglo-Saxon by virtue of genetic inheritance, so to speak, poses certain problems. For example, in the United States, a large portion of the black population, which has been here as long as the white population, a large portion of the black population remains essentially in the ghetto culture and in a kind of sustained poverty, or poverty relieved by government, but in considerable cultural disorder and despair. Look at more recent things. Look at the large Islamic, or the sizable Islamic, entry into American society, just as it has entered into, the life of the UK and other West European countries. We've had occasional honor murders done by brothers or fathers of their sisters or daughters in this country. Honor murders because somehow they have not dated properly, or they've chosen to accept a date with somebody who was not himself a Muslim. There are other such survivals of quite different cultures, quite different notions of what family is about. And one, you could argue, well, all of that's going to be handled by assimilation across the generations. But in England, for example, we get assimilated British-born Muslims who sometimes get together and do terrorism, as they did in the British subways just a few years ago, as they often try to do in this country, though they are foiled by our very effective intellectual apparatus.
Right. I think there's two big points you made there. One is with regard to our African-American fellow citizens and their historical experience here. And we speak about this in the book. Of course, the great contradiction to the story of assimilation and a sort of happy story is the hardship that they've suffered over 400 years, 250 years of slavery, 100 years of Jim Crow, and 50 years since the Civil Rights Act of at best, incomplete success. And that is, that's something that's a story whose final pages won't be written for many, many, many years, long after we're gone. But we hope that, we're going to see, some more success in that community and some more progress toward, preserving what's good in their culture and what's great in their culture and, but still, have more success at the kind of, game of American life.
Incidentally, now, but very significantly for what you develop in this book, and of course you treat of this in the book as well, when it comes to family and nuclear family, good to kids, but also pushing them out into the world with skills that they've acquired, with confidence and optimism and knowledge that they've acquired, that doesn't seem to happen in the black world in America these days. In that basic, simple social statistic, essentially 4 out of 5 black kids are born, quote, out of wedlock.
Right.
And they don't have fathers. They don't have present fathers who are in continuing relationship with their mothers.
Right. And this is a disaster. And one of the things that you need to have to make the assimilation process work is what I think can be called loosely cultural confidence. 100 years ago, during the height of the massive immigration to the USA from Eastern and Southern Europe, things were not easy for people who came here, but they moved to a country where the people who lived here felt quite certain that what they had was good and worth keeping, and that if you were to come here, you were expected to play by certain rules. The sexual revolution of the 1960s, the birth control pill, which transformed male-female relations, the disintegration of traditional marriage to a large degree, all this stuff is going on and has happened in really breathtaking speed in terms of historical developments. How this will ultimately play out is impossible to say. My speculation is that all kinds of things that happen in history, there's movements and there's counter-movements. In the USA at the time of the founding, there were far more out-of-wedlock births than there were a couple of generations later. There's a reaction. People see that they're not happy with how things have gone, and there's religious revivals and all kinds of other things we can't really hope to predict that can turn that around. And my sense is that the whatever successes the feminism and the women's movement and the birth control pill and the sexual revolution, whatever positives may have come out of all that, a disintegration of family life and the hardship it's inflicting on men, women, and children in the country are going to provoke some counter-reaction and some reassessment. So, you know, I wish I had more facts to point to. I only have bits of anecdote of things I see here and there amongst people who are in, you know, religious communities and who are serious about these things. But that's at least our hope.
Well, one interesting sociological fact is that black family disorganization and the rise of illegitimacy in terms of new births really has developed only in fairly recent years. When Pat Moynihan did his book on black America, the rate was 30%. Since then, it rose to 75 or 80% of the births being illegitimate. And a good deal of that seems to be traceable to the social welfare laws, which essentially drove of fathers out of the household.
I think that's right. And I think it's also becoming increasingly clear that this is not so much a distinctly black phenomenon. We see it increasingly the case in lower income white people of whatever ethnic background. We're seeing a similar pattern emerging.
That's exactly the point made by Charles Murray in his important book of last year,
in which
he essentially says there are two cultures in America now.
Right.
And most of the social pathology indices that we're so concerned about flow from that, essentially, he uses the term working class culture rather than middle class culture.
Correct. And Murray also, I think, is the person who used the expression that the well-to-do people in America need to preach what they practice.
Yes.
If you look at well-off Americans, precisely from Murray's book, which I confess I've only read an article by him summarizing the book. It's one of many books that sits there glaring at me from a stack that I haven't gotten to yet. But the fact is, amongst the more successful people, you have two-income families. People are well-educated. They care very much about their kids. They're, in their own way, as moralistic as mid-Victorian people were. Yet, they shy from saying that other people should adopt the same practices and be somewhat more missionary about it. And they don't want to do that. But that may not last. Another generation of people living like this and being enjoying some success and seeing their fellow citizens not getting it with the program, we may see people pushing more and more for a more orderly domestic life.
Now, let's talk about those children, whether of the middle class as they go forward towards 2040, and for that matter, those even in what Robert Kennedy used to call the underclass, which was a rather pejorative, but at the same time it conveyed the nature of the problem, and hopefully they too, in increasing number, will see the value of family life, will see the value of education and knowledge and acquired skills and application to serious requirements in the working world. So these young people are going forward and will construct America 3.0.
Mm-hmm.
I've been raising the question of why they would be so motivated, but what in fact is the fuller and detailed shape of that America 3.0 that they will be constructing that many are already beginning to lay the foundations for?
We see a few pretty big trends. And one of them is that the government sector at all levels, federal, state, county, and municipal in this country, have taken on obligations far beyond what they're ever going to realistically be able to pay. And as a result, there will be some species of default by many of them or all of them in the years ahead. What this means is that the notion that we're going to have a permanent class of dependent people is not going to work very well because the dependency requires that the checks don't bounce and that the checks continue to come. And I think it's going to be an unpleasant process for many people as that ability of the government to maintain them is going to cease to exist or become much diminished. This is not something we're advocating. We're not saying this is wonderful. It would be great if we had a society so prosperous we could take care of people who need it from the surplus. I don't think that's going to happen. So we see the government sector as in the promises it's made throughout the 20th century welfare state blue model, as Walter Russell Mead calls it, being unable to sustain itself. So as that happens, that's going to cause people to have to change their ways.
And that predicts most particularly or most specifically, among other things, I suppose, the decline and maybe the disappearance, say, of Social Security.
Well, you know, when I was a kid reading National Review that my dad would get, there was a chart, this was in the 70s, showing the lines crossing where the claims versus the revenues would cross. And I thought to myself all the way back then, gee, I'm working here at this, my minimum wage job and they're taking money and I'm never going to see any. How solvent that's ever going to be is an open question. My sense is that it's simply not going to be able on the current track it's on to pay nearly what it's promised over the coming decades. So if that's the case, there's a couple of things that can be done. We could either allow it to sort of stagger on and have happenstance and political deals and jerry-rigging and have these things stagger on and people getting less and less money and less of what they've been promised and the politically weak suffering the most. We advocate an open, public, transparent process to get all these obligations on the table and resolved once and for all.
Well, and what you really advocate is that most of these obligations finally can only be handled by declaring and meaning bankruptcy.
To some degree, that's right. A scheduled reduction.
That's governments declaring bankruptcy.
Correct.
Including state governments, city governments, and the national government.
Right.
Does the national government ultimately also have to declare bankruptcy of the sort that will enable it to put aside its international obligations so that the billions, the trillions invested in American governmental bonds don't have to be paid out?
Well, our sense is that bondholders would rather be guaranteed something than face the happenstance of random political events and defaults that are unscheduled and unknowable. Now, as to our military commitments, our ninth and final chapter in the book is on foreign policy and defense policy. And we advocate what we consider a moderate realist position on that. We're blessed right now without facing a hegemonic challenger like Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union. The Chinese are our creditors and trading partners and are not driven by a ideological fervor to do anything too crazy. I think we've got ourselves a few decades, hopefully, of relative peace, and we should take advantage of that by not over-investing in the military and certainly not embarking on foreign adventures. Just as we believe the family structure of America makes us the way we are, foreign countries are the same way. And the idea that we can impose a political system or an economic system or our cultural values on them by compulsion has proven unsuccessful in practice, and the theory supports the practice. We should be very, very careful about commitments like that.
You know, as I read your book, I'm impressed by the thought, by the integration of very interesting economic and sociologic themes, and for that matter, by the vigorous writing style. But I have one big yes but. One thing that I think you may have missed, or that I see as the fly in the ointment, or indeed the elephant, the unacknowledged elephant in the national room.
I am on the edge of my seat.
Well, you assume that we are what we are because we've maintained the nuclear family in the Anglo-Saxon tradition in a way which has produced certain kinds of individuals. We've reviewed that already in this conversation. And you assume the nuclear family will persist. I am not at all sure that it will. I think it has already shown significant signs of decay in this country up to the present moment. We've mentioned illegitimacy, and you pointed out quite rightly that even as black illegitimacy has risen to 80%, white illegitimacy, or Caucasian generally, has risen from about 7% to 30%. That those are the current relevant figures. I see a number of other things that argue against or predict poorly for the maintenance of that healthy nuclear family. A second is the general coarsening of human relationships. As if you've been a college professor for a long time, as I have been, one has noted the change. The emergence, for example, and it's only symptomatic, of the so-called hookup culture tells you a great deal. Boys and girls in college, young men and young women in college, still go to bed together, but at greater cost to women because the men essentially have favored the so-called hookup relationship, which means a one-night stand usually, and thank you, ma'am, slim slam, bang, bang, and thank you, ma'am, goodbye. I've talked to a psychiatrist at one of the Western universities who finds considerable psychological casualty in her female students and patients on the basis of that hookup culture, yet they all pay it lip service, and they pay it behavioral service. Third factor, the decay and rejection of marriage itself as an institution. That's evident by marriage being entered later than it used to be entered earlier. It's favored. It's also indicated by simply less marriage in the society and more, quote, living together. A heavy divorce rate, which continues at the same pace. Yet another factor is the feminist devaluation of men and marriage itself. That's radical feminism, but it established a pattern of criticism and of contempt or veiled mockery, which has affected the possibility of men and women really making families together in an effective way. It may have something to do with the continuing high level of the divorce system. Something else I would note, and in this I run the risks of violating the norms of political correctness, which is one of the great burdens of our society.
But
I'll say it straight. The legitimation and celebration of homosexuality.
Right.
And political correctness, you know, that sounds like human rights and civil rights and fine, and we all say that. And I sort of would go with that far with it myself. Yes, the privacy of the bedroom should be respected. But we've had more than just respecting the privacy of the bedroom. We've had a kind of a celebration through the mass media, through our entertainment narratives, and through political preachment, a celebration of gayness as somehow the new look of sexuality. Various gay organizations have got access to the school systems in some states in this country. Massachusetts is a very good case in point. Essentially, there people come in and lecture the kids about, you know, you may be one of us, and give it a chance. Don't put it aside, because it's a good way of life, just as the way of life of your mother and father has probably been. In general, we're prevented from an honest assessment of what the institutionalization and celebration of gay marriage does to weaken, if it does, and some people have argued that it does to weaken the respect for or the motivation towards the shaping of conventional nuclear families. All of those factors, and you could name lots of others, it seems to me, tend to suggest that the nuclear family simply ain't what it used to be and may not be capable of full restoration.
That is a very rich and fat-free statement of what I would call the cultural conservative case for the decline of the American family and the rotten state that the country's in. And I don't particularly disagree with any of that.
And it's been offered to you by a cultural conservative.
I pretty much am one myself. But let's do this. Let's step back a little bit. What we're saying is that there's a particular mindset, set of habits, set of expectations, things that are embedded in our practices, in our language, in the way we treat each other, all of the things that even go down to the level of things that can't even be articulated that exist in this English-speaking world. And these are distinct to us and unique to us. And the things you're talking about have occurred very rapidly in history. This is all two generations. And we're talking two generations against 500, 1,000, possibly 1,500 years of a continuous pattern. Now, the question really is, and we can't answer it now. If both of us somehow miraculously lived another century, we could look back and say, have we reached some kind of major parting in the road where we're going to take a detour and go down a path very different from what we've done for many centuries? Or is this explosion going to be worked through? Now, 100 years ago, you had masses of people moving to the cities, living in dirty, crowded conditions, lots of illegitimacy, lots of people from foreign countries who weren't living the way we expected them to live. My ancestors were those people, the people who already lived here in the USA, okay? And you had Hogarth's Gin Lane, right, in England in the 1700s. People moving in from the countryside, getting into alcoholism, kids being born willy-nilly, who knows who dad is. We've been through some of this before. Probably not to the degree of severity we have now, and not to the kind of degree of public acclaim of some of the behavior that we've seen now. But my sense is that much of this stuff doesn't work. And as we talked a little while ago, the people who are getting by and doing well in American society live a much more conventional type of life. We have to have a certain amount of patience that if something can't go on, it won't. Just as a socialistic approach in economics and in governance is going to fail you sooner than later in a generation or two, by the same token, I think these are unsuccessful and unhappy ways to do things. I agree with you. People's private business should be their private business. I have zero interest in having the government come in, for example, and tell me about my sex life or anybody else's. But, you know, celebrating something and in the public schools is something else, and that's something that should be subject to local democratic control. But on the gay marriage issue, which is, I don't think it's possible for there to be a touchier issue, but we touch it a tiny bit. Notice that even there, in the English-speaking world, you see people pushing for marriage. And they don't seem to be pushing for polygamous marriage. They seem to be pushing for nuclear, two-person, family-type life.
Ah, well, if you go to some...
As odd as that may seem.
If you go to some of the law schools and talk to some of the leading law professors on the left side, as many are, it turns out that polyamory, a term which is now in increasing use, is seen as an inevitable next step. If we go to gay marriage, in all likelihood, and there's no constitutional basis for opposing it, the next step would be to restore a plural marriage of various kinds. It could be a polygyny of the kind practiced by Mormons and practiced by Muslims the world over, or it could be polyandry, single wife, multiple husbands, or it could be group marriages in which, in a co-op in which 25 people live, they all have access to one another sexually, et cetera. In fact, that's an old American tradition as well. That's the way some of the utopian societies of the 19th century lived.
Particularly, and they didn't succeed.
Well, they succeeded in a way. The Oneida community in Oneida, New York, ultimately gave up that sort of thing, but their workshop for the production of silverware and other things still persists as a major business. That's purely an aside of no great pertinence. But yes, I certainly take your point. But it seems to me that social conservatism, with its concern for preservation and restoration of traditional values, certainly as regards the meaning of family and the loyalties that membership in family does require of us, that it seems to me is a theme more honored in the breach than in the observance these days, and even opposed by many of the organizations which we otherwise honor as serving freedom, one of them being, as I suggest, feminism at its most radical. But I am carrying on too much about this. Let us get back to the image of the coming society. Mm-hmm. You agreed earlier that technology is one of the great movers. And of course, the technology that you're very interested in, you and your co-author, James Bennett, and you are, if you've forgotten, the co-authors of the book, America 3.0. Let me give the full subtitle, Rebooting American Prosperity in the 21st Century, Why America's Greatest Days Are Yet to Come. And that book, just published by Encounter Books. And what we've mentioned, but now I want to get back to, is essentially what the future will bring. You do agree, surely, and indeed that you make this very clear in the book, that you think the key to our future is the digital culture and digital technology.
That's obviously a fundamental part of the change we're going through, yeah.
So what is the continued growth and expansion in all directions at once of digital technology? What is that doing to transform our lives? How will it have transformed our lives by the time we get to your target year of 2040?
Well, everybody on Earth who is engaged in any kind of business is going to be able to find their customers and clients wherever they need, colleagues and coworkers to work collectively and communally. The tools to collaborate on projects and work together are going to get better and better. We see a future where small and family-scale businesses will be much more viable again, much like in the founding era, except they'll be enormously more productive and enormously more networked and tied into the rest of the world economy.
That sounds like the corporation being replaced by a kind of return to what used to be called cottage industry.
Well, to some extent, that's right. But another way to look at it is this. Our Hyde Park neighbor and the great economist Ronald Coase recently died at age 102, I think, and he was productive up to the very end. And Professor Coase, back in the late 30s, wrote a paper on the nature of the firm. And I'm kind of embarrassed that his name isn't in our index because his spirit permeates our thinking. And he said, why do we have firms anyway? If everybody has perfect information, why can't you get up every day and contract for what you'll do that day or that hour or that minute and have everybody just working at their most efficient way that way? And it turned out a lot of it has to do with the cost of information, preserving your intellectual property, simplifying dealings with people inside the company. But as those types of barriers give way to digital technology, the need to have people amassed on a permanent basis in large organizations is going to be less and less, and people will be organizing themselves more and more in a task-based type of arrangement. Now, the fear here, of course, is that everyone's going to be immiserated by this, but you know, the idea that large businesses are going to have enormous workforces that stay employed for decades has been withering away for a long time anyway. We need to embrace this and see that the great source of job creation is not employment by large businesses, but it's self-employment and startup type businesses. And that process and that trend we hope will continue. And we'd really like to see the government and the regulatory machinery and the tax machinery more or less get out of the way and let that process continue.
Now, speaking of government, there's a very interesting further prediction in your book. That is of something like the breakdown or certainly the reorganization of government in this country. And I assume you would make similar predictions for our cousin countries, say, of Western Europe. You predict that by 2040, we may have not 50 American states, but 70 or 75 of them. Why?
Well, it's pretty speculative, but it's interesting. In American history, actually, we've had the subdivision of large groups on several occasions. I think there's four instances where we had a state that broke up into two states, Maine and Massachusetts, Vermont made out of pieces of New Hampshire and New York, West Virginia, and then Kentucky both breaking off from Virginia. If you get to a situation like in California, we have an enormous ungovernable community that's far too big to have responsive government, as the same problem we have now with the federal government taking on too many duties. It makes a certain amount of sense to just to break them up into smaller units. Also, if these entities are facing bankruptcy, have spent more than they can sustain, it makes a certain amount of sense that part of the deal for any bailout or any assistance would be that they break themselves up into things that can govern themselves better and that are more coherent given the size of the populations they're going to have. Now, we absolutely wedded. We think that's certainly going to happen. No, but we think it's an idea that's radical, but it should be on the table. People should think about it. Our founders were open to building new states out of the wilderness. We should be open to the prospect that the arrangements we have now aren't a permanent configuration, and that they can be turned into something that suits us better if we need to do it.
You seem to want as well and to urge that we think about devolving or shifting more power to smaller units, back in essence to the county or the town, sort of reinvigorating local government in a communitarian way.
That's true. Yeah, the founders, you know, saw that you needed to have congressional districts of a certain size just so that people would have some kind of face-to-face knowledge of each other and what was going on. And you know, we're so far beyond that now. It's you can't possibly do that. If you divided the country, the USA, into cantons like the Swiss have with the same average population, we'd have 3,000 of them, which is how many counties we have, more or less. So also, one of the problems, of course, is local government can be as opaque and corrupt as anything. In Illinois, we know that better than most people.
Yes, indeed, we do.
This has to be tied into technology making things more transparent and people, frankly, being a little more activist and motivated to keep their eye on these things. But we hope that the transparency technology we have now could be used to make radical transparency where everything's out in the open, and it can also be used to conceal things and hide the ball. And it's a political decision and a legal decision how that's going to play out. We have to decide that we're going to push for transparency and not permit the type of things that we're seeing now. I hope that's what's going to happen.
Have you and James Bennett read and been at all impressed by the work of Leopold Kohr, K-O-H-R?
I confess that I don't know the work of Mr. Kohr.
He was the author. Viennese in origin, came to this country after his training at London School of Economics. And he was the author of a book that for a while got tremendous attention and has now indeed had a new revived reign of influence, particularly in Britain, where somebody just the other day wrote a major piece about it in The Telegraph. The book that I'm referring to is titled The Breakdown of Nations. Kohr, 50 years ago, predicted that the national state, the nation state, is going to become less and less functional, less and less effective. Similar thought was found in the work of an important guy at LSE, namely a fellow named Mitrani, M-I-T-R-A-N-Y, David Mitrani, if I remember it. Mm-hmm. My colleague of years ago here at the university, Hans Morgenthau, was
sure.
a great personal friend of and a great advocate for Mitrani's work on how governments decline as international organizations somehow take over many of their functions. The Mitrani and the Kohr visions are not the same, but the Kohr vision is that basically things have to go local again and will go that way because that's what turns out to be more functional. That's a way of avoiding problems that get worse and worse and worse in the large industrialized, corporatized, governmentalized societies.
Right. And another simple point that the founders understood is this, is if you have a one-size-fits-all program, if it's unsuccessful, and it's bound to be from time to time, everyone is stuck with it. If you have, just as in a market economy, you have thousands of possible alternatives, and the ones that work are the ones that survive and carry on. You know, if we have, for example, use Obamacare as an example, we have a set of mandated things that have to be in insurance policies throughout the whole society. If whatever committee or community group of people picked that got it wrong, everyone's stuck with it. You know, if you have much more important decision-making pushed downwards and you have people have the capacity due to technology to monitor it more closely, I think we're going to get much better results. And on the point of the sort of decline of the state, Martin Van Crubble, the military historian, also had a book on that too, the idea that the modern state has taken on simply more than it can possibly handle. And it's being beset on all sides by alternatives in the economy and in unlawful activity and all kinds of other things that are weakening it, and it can't keep all its promises.
This book that you and James Bennett have done, titled again, America 3.0, is indeed very vigorously written, rather informally written, but it gets all of its ideas across with great competence and indeed sometimes with almost amusing style. And I note that in the introductory chapter to the book, or rather in the, yes, in the introductory chapter, you end by saying that the very last sentence of that chapter is, this is the only sentence in this book which will mention the name Barack Obama. And indeed, you live up to that promise. Why then is consideration of where we are now and the increase in governmental power, or the attempt to increase and spread governmental power, even as also they intend apparently to spread the wealth around more than just a little, more than he confided to Joe the Plumber years ago. Mm-hmm. Why does Obama and Obamism and its works and ways not show up in this book?
Well, it does a little, but there's a few reasons. One is we tried to take a tone that isn't too heated. We wanted to try to be reasonable. We're both conservatives, but we want to reach out to people who aren't necessarily already in agreement with us. I have a spiel I have on this that I think of as why progressives should welcome our message. And we want to be able to talk to everyone and talk about things in terms of history and where we're going. And once you start talking about President Obama, and I discipline myself not to speak of him disparagingly, you can immediately get very emotional. Furthermore, the amount of scrutiny he's subject to is so intense, and so many people have opinions about him and his doings, and many of them are well-informed. I don't think we added that much value by getting into a lot of detail about him. And also, if we're right that the America 2.0 welfare state 20th century blue model government is in its final phase of doubling down and trying to keep doing things more coercively and more expensively that they've always done, and it's not going to work. In that sense, Mr. Obama, for whatever his personal interest is in it, more of a symptom of events than a cause of events.
But a great and significant achievement and further expanding that welfare state is, of course, just now at last instituted and off and running.
Is it an achievement?
Well, Obamacare, of course, is what I'm talking about.
Sure. I mean, Social Security more or less worked for 70 or 80 years. Medicare cost way too much from the moment it came out, but was tolerable and people came to rely on it for decades. This thing, even without regard to the software mess that they've created, they get 3 years to get it ready and failed to do so. But let's assume that that's just a sort of stumble at the gate. It's structurally not going to work. So what we see is the welfare state model is out of ideas. It's just enormously expensive.
Well, let's focus in on that. I agree with you. It probably won't work, but it's there, and they're not going to give it up. And if they go on building potential majorities voting for Democratic candidates, as they're doing in part by the approach to legalizing illegal immigrants and otherwise propagandizing them, a man who's had great influence in all of this, but who has not been fully reported, is indeed another former colleague from the University of Chicago, Cass Sunstein, one of whose books is titled Nudge, meaning you get your things done by working indirectly, in some sense by people not knowing how you are manipulating them.
Right.
And he gives rules for how you can nudge people in the direction you want them to go. It may well be that for the next 3 or 4 decades, the Democratic Party or something like it will continue to organize American economic and social life the way the Obama administration has been doing. That argues against the coming of America 3.0, or doesn't it?
If they can pull it off for 3 or 4 decades, I mean, they have been punching into a vacuum because the other side, and I am megalomaniacal enough to say I hope my book in a small way, our book in a small way adds to this. You can't fight something with nothing. And they can say, we've got the welfare state model. If there's a problem, the government will fix it. And we have had a vacuum of alternative ideas and a vacuum of a framework of thinking about alternative ideas and a goal to work toward. And I don't think that that vacuum is going to persist forever. You know, politics abhors a vacuum just like everything else. and the approach of a kind of a insider Republican Party of just, we'll give you the same thing but a few pennies less on the dollar, isn't working. And ambitious politicians are going to be looking for ideas to oppose this because people are dissatisfied. An ineffective representation of dissatisfied people will be replaced by more effective efforts. And I think we're going to see people coming up with alternatives to things like Obamacare to move us toward a more market type and more decentralized and more personalized and more personal choice driven model, even where it's the government assisting people who need it. So I don't see 30 or 40 years of is some kind of juggernaut. I look at these guys. I look at Nancy Pelosi and this bill they passed. I look at Mr. Obama and his efforts. I do not see a juggernaut that's going to carry all before it for another generation and a half. I see people who had the good fortune to win an election, to aggressively push something they passed on a party line vote. Change on this scale in American life has not passed on a party line vote in the past.
Quite true.
So I simply don't see that this direction is going to continue as strong as it looks. You know, any effort, political, military, what have you, looks powerful at its moment of success, but I don't see it lasting that long.
I hope your building isn't on fire.
No, my building's right next to a fire station.
Oh, that's
it. So every crisis in this end of the loop is made my crisis as well. It's just how it is.
You are, of course, I haven't even said this about you. You are, of course, a practicing lawyer.
I am.
Here in Chicago. Yep. You're a JD from Indiana University,
right,
in Bloomington, and your BA from the University of Chicago in Hyde Park, Chicago, indeed. In what you've just been saying, I think I hear an implicit critique of many present conservative commentators, thinkers, activists. That is, you seem to be saying they're certainly critical of what we've got, but they're not really providing a significant alternative vision for the future, not advocating anything other than get the rascals out.
That's absolutely right. It's pretty disappointing. It's sort of funny, you know, I'm a lawyer and it wasn't my ambition 5 years ago to do this, but as Bennett and I looked around, we said, no one is putting together the social science in quite the way we have. And there aren't enough people presenting a coherent picture of where we ought to go. So I guess we have to do it. I don't think what we've said about the transition that we're going through or America in the future or where the politics and economics of America will be is the last word. I hope we're something more like the first word. I hope we're going to provoke some discussion about this and what we're actually going to see in the future and what alternatives we're going to have to all of the things you and I have talked about today that don't work, a government sector that doesn't work, a culture that seems to be dysfunctional and destructive. All of this stuff we need alternatives to be presented that people can look at and assess and decide to move toward. Merely saying what we have now is no good, and if it continues, we're doomed, is not a basis for action.
Are there any conservative voices, apart from yours, that seem to you to be on the right track these days in the American debate?
Absolutely. There's a lot of people who I like, we both like. I don't think, for example, Walter Russell Mead would even call himself a conservative, but he is an intellectual hero of ours, and he's very, very good. Joel Kotkin, I don't think he'd necessarily call himself a conservative either. Very, very good on where the country's going and what its sources of strength are. Kevin Williamson had a book come out recently called The End is Near and It's Going to Be Great or something like
that. Yeah, we did a program with him. It's on the series that you're now contributing to.
Terrific. He's similar in a lot of ways to us. I'd love to have a chance to meet him and talk about this stuff. There's a professor at the University of Chicago Business School, Luigi Zingales, who has a book called A Capitalism for the People.
Yeah.
Which is terrific. And if you haven't had him on, you've got to get him over and talk to you.
Had him on my radio program, I think, about a year ago.
Wonderful. And he has a lot of reform proposals in his book. My only critique of his book, it's a 5-star book, is that all of the reform proposals are scabbed through the book. There should be an appendix at the end where they're all listed because they could be handed out to 435 members of the House to try to get some of them enacted. These people are all quite good. I could come up with more. I think there's lots of people who are quite good, but they're all sort of, they're not cohering into a movement, and they're not cohering around a sort of cluster of ideas about where the country ought to be going.
Well, apart from individuals, what are the institutions that are off on the right track? By institutions, I mean organizations or think tanks or what have you. Where is the good conservative thought coming from, apart from your significant contribution in the new book?
Why, thank you. It's tough to say. Funny, on the narrower point, I think the best think tank for policy proposals I see is Illinois focused. I think the Illinois Policy Institute is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I wish we had an American Policy Institute. I wish we could clone those guys, send them to DC with a budget 10 times as big and do exactly the same thing except for the whole country. They're terrific. I look at National Review. I look at Reason Magazine. I read a lot of books. I'm not seeing any major force out there that I say that's our rallying point. That's where the flag has been planted in the ground. Not yet.
Well, you've made a very important contribution to what I hope will be a continuing debate, a continuing conversation among people of influence and people who aspire to some influence over the planning process, over the shaping of the world to come, which is being shaped and reshaped every day, even as we grow older. Michael J. Lotus, that's spelled L-O-T-U-S, by the way, and James C. Bennett are the co-authors of America 3.0. And again, let's give the full subtitle, Rebooting American Prosperity in the 21st Century, Why America's Greatest Days Are Yet to Come, published by Encounter Books. I hope you're right that the greatest days are yet to come.
We have to make it happen, Milton.
And this has been a great hour in the present. I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.